Welcome to the Kona Edge, where you'll discover what the best triathletes in the world do to give them the edge.
Welcome on to yet another edition of the Kona Edge. I'm Brad Brown. It's awesome to have you with us today. And I'm super, super stoked to be able to welcome our next guest onto the podcast. We've been chatting back and forth for a while over email. Just been really quite difficult to sort of coordinate schedules. He's been traveling a ton of late, and you'll find out more about why in today's podcast too. But he is a well-respected sports scientist. He lives in New Zealand, originally from England, but is doing some amazing things in various sporting codes. So super, super chuffed to be able to welcome our next guest onto the podcast all the way in the land of the long white clouds in Auckland, New Zealand. Please give a warm welcome to Dr. Daniel Plumes. Doc, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Brad. It's great to be here.
I'm super excited because I get to share some incredible athlete stories, and we're going to touch on yours as well. But I really want to dig into the scientific thing side of things today, and I think I'm going to geek out in a big way, and I think a lot of people are going to love this chat. But let's talk a little bit about your background before we get into what you were doing in Rio and that sort of thing, what you're doing now. But you come from a very competitive triathlon background. You were really quick, and not that you aren't anymore, but at the sort of peak of your performance, you're a racing snake of note.
Yeah, I was not too bad. I mean, my life has been triathlon pretty much. I did my first swim run event when I was just 9 years old. So my dad's a bit of a keen triathlete, and then I went through the British system. I was a kind of British junior champion. Did some high quality under 23 level. I was at Loughborough University, and there I was mostly there as training and doing a sports science degree. But after that finished, I got the opportunity to actually go and have a scholarship at the Leeds Performance Centre, which is where the Alistair and Johnny Brownlee were at that time. And they were just juniors. And I got the opportunity to do a master's degree in sports science and also be the assistant coach there. And that kind of took me off as an athlete. Full time, like just really focusing on myself as an athlete and focus on triathlon from more of a sports science coaching standpoint. So yeah, I've never looked back since, really.
Do you think it's helped you from an athlete perspective having that sports science background that you've been able to be really analytical about what you do personally, or has that been a bit of a hindrance that you almost feel like you're a hamster or a guinea pig and you're testing everything out on yourself and it becomes a bit taxing?
I say this to a lot of people is I wish I knew what I know now when I was just, 15, 16, when I was in my early teens, because I think I would have been a much better athlete as a result. But I do think you get into the stage where I agree with you that you can almost have a lot, paralysis by analysis. But I think as you learn more and more and more and your knowledge gets good, you can almost separate the shit from the clavier, part of my French, and it actually gets you quite you can actually use it to its full advantage without really it hindering you. Yeah.
All right. And I find it quite interesting too that you talk about growing up around the sport and a dad who's quite a keen triathlete. What is it? What's the fascination with triathlon as a sport? And we'll touch on some of the other things you did with regards to rowing and the Rio Olympics. But why for you has it been triathlon?
I guess it's one of those natural things that I always found I was good at it, And I think that's always the case is when you're younger and you try a variety of different sports. And I did try a variety of different sports, but for some reason triathlon was a thing that I was best at. I loved the fact that I loved the diversity of three different sports as well, and I still love that diversity of three different sports. I think there's no better way to keep fit and healthy than have that that diversity. What am I going to do today? You can swim, you can cycle, you can run, I just fell in love with it. And I have a lot of friends who were training with me when we were younger. And they carried on going and going and tried to chase a professional dream. But I think I was quite fortunate that I jumped out of trying to chase the dream of being a professional quite early on, and I never really lost that passion as a result. I think that passion still sits with me today.
That is a real thing. I mean, you talk about burnout in the sport. We see it so often, people who do chase, and not necessarily just to chase the professional dream, but who chase the age group dream of qualifying for Kona and racing. You see it time and time again that they'll race hard for a few seasons, and then they're nowhere, and they've just really burnt themselves out. Do you feel lucky that you've almost avoided that?
Yeah, I do for sure. And I actually quite enjoy the fact that it's part of, it makes a difference. When triathlon's your full-time job and that's all you have, it's quite different to when it's just your hobby. And when it's just your hobby, the flame keeps burning for much longer, I think.
Neil, how do you...
I was going to say that I now, I can't wait to get training again, whereas know that when I was just training full-time, there was periods where you actually dread training, and now I actually look forward to my alarm going off in the morning so I can get up and go swimming.
That's awesome. But how often is that the case too, where you'll see an athlete who's promising and is on the verge of turning pro and decides to turn pro, and all of a sudden they were working full-time, now they're not, and their performance almost goes backwards because now this is all they're doing, and you speak about the analysis or paralysis by analysis, they end up just really over-analyzing everything, and it's almost to their detriment. Sometimes you want them to continue working because they're a better athlete when they're really busy.
Yeah, and I think that's very true, and I don't think it's just analysis by paralysis by analysis, but I also think it's a lot to do with mindset and the ability to actually switch your mind off from racing and training and onto something different. I think that's quite a healthy thing to be able to do. I think the problem when you're full-time and you're a triathlete, that ability to focus on other things and not think about training and racing can be problematic.
One of the things that pops up time and time again here on the Kona Edge is the time management side of things and balancing and keeping all the balls in the air that you need to juggle. You're extremely busy. You're a sports scientist. You work with some really good athletes, and we'll touch on some of the people you work with in a moment, and not just in the triathlon sphere, but you're also a great athlete in your own right. How do you get that balance right? You're married. You've got a domestic life to worry about. It's tough, isn't it?
Yeah. I think that's the greatest challenge of all age group triathletes trying to get to Kona. I mean, I'm quite fortunate in that I do have a lot of sports equipment at my disposal all the time. So even when I'm at work, I've got a gym, in the office and a pool. If I'm here in Auckland, they've got a pool, a 50-meter pool in the office as well. So it's quite easy for me to go down at lunchtime and have a swim, for example, or jump on the treadmill, or just jump on a trainer. So that does make my life a little bit easier, but at the same time, when it's really on, say it's really on at rowing, those guys, they're training all day, right? So they'll be on the water at 7 o'clock in the morning, which means getting a session in before they're actually training, like most people would do, is really very difficult. So it has its challenges, but I think I've done it for so long, I've just got very good at planning my days and my weeks, and I always have the training that I want to do, and I will the previous day before I'm set out to do it, I'll make sure that those times are blotted out so I can get that training done, and just make sure that the training's of the right type and quality.
Yeah, you mentioned planning, and I think that's exactly what it boils down to. You also touched on the rowers. Let's talk about your trip to Rio with the New Zealand rowing team. I think you had 11 boats racing in Rio. It was a pretty successful trip, wasn't it?
Yeah, we got two gold and one silver medal from the rowers, which was, to be honest with you, we were actually slightly disappointed with that result. We had a target of getting 5 medals, but we came up a bit short, but that is the beast of the Olympics. It's a very different game to the World Championships and other competitions. But you've got to take the wins where you get them, right? And two golds and a silver isn't too shabby. So yeah, it was good. It was a long time away. I was away 4 months in total before the Olympics, and I'm pretty happy to be back into some normal life now.
I'm sure. But it's incredible to be part of an event like that. I mean, the London Games in 2012 were spectacular. Rio, obviously very different. I had friends who went to both, and both had the positives, both had the negatives. But it's just, I mean, the Olympics, for an athlete to perform is almost a once-in-a-lifetime. If you get the opportunity, you have to go.
Yeah, exactly. And I was fortunate enough to be I went to London and I went to Rio. But yeah, there were two very different games. But I think that's also comes in. I think that's a part of the skill is the ability for the athlete to have the right mindset and adapt to the challenges. Because with rowing, especially, there was a lot of challenges with events changing and times of day changing with the weather and the situation. And the best athletes are the ones who could deal with it in a positive mindset and not let it affect them. And you know, and I think that's quite a skill.
As far as the approach goes to training a rower, possibly for Olympic success, to training a triathlete for world championship success, yes, they're two very different sporting codes, but from a mindset perspective and a sort of scientific thinking behind it, how similar are the two?
I think that winning mindset, I mean, kind of this goes out of my area of physiology, I guess, a bit, but I guess it's more in the realm of psychology and coaching. But the mindset thing is just that winning mindset, I believe, is the same whatever sport you're in. And there's one thing that I've learned over the years of just being around guys who are multiple Olympic gold medal winners and multiple world champions. They have a very different mindset to the people who aren't winning, in that they really, and it's quite hard to explain, but they really do see winning and nothing else. And that's all they can vision. It's like the world doesn't exist until there's no world after the Olympic Games. Everything goes towards the Olympic Games. And after that, it's just a black hole. And everything is around winning on the day and putting yourself in the position where winning is everything. And that's kind of, what the real winners tend to do. And they can't understand. We have one rower, have a men's pair, and they haven't lost a race in 69. They haven't lost a race in 69 races, five or seven times world champion, double Olympic gold medal winners, world record holders. And the guy who's in the stroke seat of that boat is quite incredible. And when you speak to him, he literally can't understand losing. It's a funny thing to, the funny thing to speak to someone like that, and it's quite hard to explain, but you speak to him about it and he can't fathom how anyone can possibly do it. It's quite remarkable.
That is incredible. Dan, you did a PhD on heart rate variability, and we chat lots about heart rate and power and the numbers. I love the fact that, I mean, a lot of people are moving, I don't want to say away from heart rate, but there's still so much that you can glean out of that information, and it's obviously something you're quite passionate about.
Yeah, I guess there's differences between what I did for my PhD, heart rate variability, and heart rate. I mean, my PhD concentrated on heart rate variability, and that was more looking at morning resting heart rate variability to look at adaptation to training, to know whether you need to do more or less training, basically. You know, to kind of get that idea of overreaching or what you might call overtraining to see if you can pick it out, which is obviously is really good for when you're training very hard and under a very heavy training load, or you've got a lot of life stresses. And and I use that a lot with my athletes and with myself. But people have moved away from training with heart rate. But I really think it's an absolute mistake for people not to train with a heart rate monitor.
I love that. I mean, I know a lot of people are saying that they get tied up in the numbers and they almost forget what their body feels like. But that heart rate variability, particularly, like you say, the morning one, there's so much information you can pull out of that.
Yeah, you can. Yeah, and you can. You know, you could almost guide your training on a daily basis on what your morning resting heart rate say. And there's lots of apps and things now that you can just buy online that will give you that kind of information. So, yeah, I mean, I think people who are really interested in the area should definitely experiment with the possibility of using heart rate variability as part of the training, especially once they're, you know, some people are trying to go to Kona, especially age groupers, they have. The good thing about the heart rate variability is it measures your autonomic nervous system. So it's a measure of overall stress. So sympathetic stress being like fight or flight, and then the parasympathetic system, which is kind of the rest and digest, which is your more relaxation. And that sympathetic system, we can get ramped up by a variety of life stressors, lack of sleep, too much poor food, and just generally stressful meetings or being around in stressful situations, and that would show up in the high variability as well as the training. And I think for age group athletes, that's a key consideration.
Dan, you've also been quoted as saying the difference between you and a lot of other coaches is when they think of science, they think of certainty. For you, you don't think its role is to give certainty, but it's to reduce uncertainty. It's quite an interesting take on things. I like it. Can you delve into that a little bit more?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. I think when it comes to, especially as a sports practitioner, and we're giving, we're helping athletes make or coaches make decisions. There's no such thing as a certain decision, I don't think. Like, so say an athlete comes to me or a coach comes to me and they say, this person's not looking like great, I'm considering doing X. And then you can look at the data and you can inform their decision and give them more certainty. You can give them, so their decision becomes less uncertain. It's not just a feeling of, maybe I should, maybe I shouldn't. It reduces the uncertainty in the decision that they might already be making. And that's what good sports science is. It's, you might wake up in the morning, you might not be feeling that great. You might look at, then you can plug up your heart rate variability, and that just confirms a decision that you were already thinking you were of making. So it reduces the uncertainty in that decision. And that's what sports science is. It's not about, this is definitely the answer and it's fact or fiction. It's just, it's about reducing the uncertainty in the decision that might be made.
And so often people get caught up on the, because it says so in science, that's it. It's the be all and end all, and they don't move from it. And that is a huge mistake, isn't it?
Yeah, and especially in sport, because we're all individual and we all respond differently. And we often get caught up in studies. No, that doesn't work. This is the best, but it's all means and standard deviations, right? And you can rest assured that some things that have no effect is because there's just a wide variation in the response. So that means the average is not that great, but then the standard deviation is really high, which means that you don't get an effect. But in some people, it actually might have an effect. So altitude would be a prime example. If you look at the literature, altitude shows that it's more likely points that it really doesn't have that great an effect, but clearly, in a lot of individuals, they swear by it, and a lot of elite athletes swear by it. So, I don't think you can. I mean, I'm a scientist, right, and I believe in the papers and publications, but I don't. I'm also quite practical. I'm more of a practical scientist rather than an academic scientist. I think you have to look at the individual as well as the as long as the means and the general population.
Dan, something we haven't spoken about much here on the podcast is doping, and I'd love to get your sort of thought on it, and just particularly in the age group ranks, there is obviously more and more testing starting to happen, and we're seeing more and more athletes getting done for doping. Your thought on it? Should there be more testing? Is it? We also know that often the dopers are ahead of the testers. It's almost like a losing battle we're fighting, but it's just something that it's not cool that is plaguing the sport.
Yeah, it's interesting. Even I've noticed, like, I've been, in fact, in 2015, I was tested twice as an age grouper, funnily enough. I do think it is rife in age group racing, but it's probably somewhat rife in maybe in the elites. I mean, I don't really know. I'm always wary of, I keep my eye close, I keep my, my eye close to the data and results of athletes, and I just think there are sometimes abnormal performances come out of the woodwork that are very, very questionable.
Yeah, it does raise lots of flags. From an athlete coaching perspective in the world of triathlon, you work with a couple of, I don't want to say pretty decent, they're fantastic athletes, Caroline Steffen and Tim Van Berkel as well. You got some pretty decent athletes in your stable.
Yeah. So it's been great working with those two. I've been working with Caroline for nearly a year and Tim for nearly 2 years now. We have a good relationship. So I'm leaving on Tuesday to go to Boulder to be with Tim before we leave to Kona together. And then hopefully we're looking for him to get a real solid performance in Kona this year. So fingers crossed, he's in pretty good nick. So.
Awesome stuff. More traveling on the horizon.
Yeah, unfortunately. I don't really feel like getting on a plane again. at the moment. But yeah, it'll be good for Tim, especially these final build-up stages. It's good to have a companion and someone around to keep him on the straight and narrow, so to speak. So it'll be good. I'm really looking forward to it.
How much of a difference does it make that you're able to do some of the work with the athletes? Maybe not all of it, but being a decent athlete yourself, does that help a bit as a coach and as a sports scientist?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, with some of the rowers, I will, I'll ride with them and cycle with them, and it's good at building relationships and building rapport with the athletes. And when I'm with Tim, I'll do some bikes with him, and don't know if I'll be doing any running with him, but I'll just do what I can. It's good for him to have someone there, and it keeps him honest, and again, it builds a good relationship. And some of the best, as you probably know, some of the best conversations you have with people are when you're exercising. And I always find that you always have a good brainstorm, and some of the best ideas and the best conversations come when two people are exercising. So that's always a positive as well.
Mm. On a personal note, Kona, it's a special place. What do you love about the Big Island?
Well, Kona last year was my first time I've ever been there, to be honest with you. It's actually only my third ever Ironman as well. It was a real eye opener for me how hard it was, especially it was one of the hottest Konas in, I think it was like one of the hottest in 23 years. But I just love it has some kind of magical euphoria that's almost tangible. And when you step on down to the pier and you get down to Ali Drive, it's just quite amazing. As I speak to you now, actually, I have you on my Skype on my left screen. I never looked to my right on my big screen. I have a picture of the start line at Kona, which is just kind of my permanent backdrop, and it gives me such good fond memories of just being in Kona and that magical place.
You mentioned how hard it is. It must be pretty tough coming out of a brutal New Zealand winters, because your winters do get quite hectic. Going into a race like Kona at the time of the year that it is, it's tough for the guys, particularly from New Zealand, but from the Southern Hemisphere, have to train through pretty tough winters and go into the almost opposite extreme in a race like Kona.
Yeah, but, I mean, for sure. And I was fortunate last year that I was... So I haven't had a winter in 7 years, and people hate me for that, because I usually travel to Europe. And my wife always says to me, she goes, you didn't know what a winter's like. And I'm like, well, I have lived in England for quite a while. So that, and they're pretty brutal winters. But yeah, I was fortunate enough that I was with the rowing team in Europe before I did Kona. So I had a summer in Europe, and it was actually a heat wave summer. And it was very hot. And then when I got back to New Zealand, because I'm a associate with Auckland University, I have the ability to use a heat chamber. So I was getting in the heat chamber, and I could put that heat chamber to any temperature I wanted. And I was doing some heat. I was keeping my heat acclimation up. And I arrived in Kona on the Tuesday before the race, which was on the Saturday. And the heat was hot, but I think I actually still coped with it pretty well. And having lived in Singapore for 4 years, I also think you kind of maintain that plasticity of response, and you can actually heat acclimatize quite quickly.
Dan, as far as the bug biting, I mean, you said it was only your third Ironman. Once you've experienced and done it, is it under your skin now? Is it one of those things that you want to keep on doing, or do you feel like you've got it out of your system? You'll keep going back and supporting athletes, but you've had your share.
No, I'll be back for sure next year. That's the plan. So I'm hoping to. I mean, this year was never going to be on the cards because I was just too busy with Rio and I didn't really manage to get the training in. But 2017, I plan to go back and hopefully, I want to win my age group. So that's the big plan, and hopefully I might be able to achieve it. So we will see.
Do you think it's a bit of a curse being as competitive as you are, or do you like having that sort of built into you?
No, I love it. Yeah, yeah. I think I probably can be a bit of a hindrance in sometimes, just not having the ability to switch off. But I think I'm getting better at that. But yeah, I think you have to be a bit competitive to, What most people who do Ironman are that A-type personality, and I would definitely fall into that boat as well.
Yeah, it sounds like you definitely have to be to compete at that sort of level. And as far as other than the heat, I mean, what made Kona so tough for you in 2015?
I think it's just my first time at racing that course. I think it's quite a hard course mentally, especially, you know, the bike, it's just straight out and back. And then on the run, when you get up onto that Queen K and it's, you know, it's just a straight, you know, you're basically running along a highway. It's quite tough to keep focus and to keep on your game. And I don't think I was quite mentally prepared for the level of hurt that I had to go through. And I think that was quite evident in my splits as well. So if I did it again, I'd definitely approach things a little bit differently and kind of be prepared for the pinch points in the race, that really hard bits, and be ready for them. So, I mean, this year I'm going out in a couple of weeks, so it'll be a good opportunity to actually relive some of the course, and I'll definitely do the run out to the Energy Lab and ride out to Harvey and just relive some of the memories. So I'm ready to, I've got it cemented in my mind for 2017.
You think you're going to be suffering from FOMO on race day that you're not out there, but you're on the sidelines?
I don't think so. I mean, I would be if I was really fit, but because I'm not that fit, I think I'll be pleased I'm not getting amongst it, and I'll be too busy supporting Tim. I'll be living vicariously through him.
I love it. And then, Dan, you mentioned when we first started this chat that you wish you could go back to your 15-year-old self and knowing what you know now. What would you have done differently? I always ask this question, and you brought it up, so I think we can wrap it up there. What would you change? What would you do differently to what you've done?
I guess it'd be two things, really. I guess in my 15s a bit earlier, maybe my early 20s is probably a better way of looking at it. And I do two things differently. I would definitely monitor myself and my homeostatic state much more carefully to the way that I do it now. So I record every session and I'll record everything quite meticulously on Training Peaks. But also I would have a radical shift in my diet, and I'm a huge advocate of the high fat, low carb diet. And for me, that has changed. It's really changed my life. I was racing for a long time. And then last year I did 3:57 for a half Ironman, which is, you know, the best time I've ever done on very little training. And I really believe that it's, just through being smarter in the way I eat, and not just from a fat oxidation standpoint, but also from a recovery standpoint, it gives me the ability to sleep less. I seem to be able to cope with less sleep, and I seem to be able to recover from sessions even when I'm under a heavy workload in terms of actual real academic kind of work. So, and I just, you know, if I was actually just training, I just think I would bounce back and be a lot healthier as a result. I think it's quite sad that a lot of elite athletes and athletes are fit but not necessarily healthy, and that's because we're pushed by sports nutrition and sports nutrition propaganda to believe that a diet high in refined carbohydrates and sugar is good for us when it's really not. So there you go, I'll get off my soapbox now.
I love that. Well, we're going to dig deeper into that when we do chat about nutrition later on, but we'll save that for another chat. Doc, thank you so much for your time today. Much appreciated. We look forward to catching up and talking about the individual disciplines in another podcast. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Kona Edge. Don't forget to connect with us on social media. Simply search for the Kona Edge.